8:30, we have with us in the studios John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State, and both a little bit under the weather today.
This is the infirmary, right?
Yeah, that's right.
The recovery room here.
Yeah, it's your meds will be dispensed shortly in about 30 minutes.
You mean we have to wait around all that length of time?
Okay. Yeah.
Nice comics on the ceiling, by the way.
Yeah. we put those in just for you.
Right. We might as well do something in that 30 minutes while we're waiting for meds to arrive.
Yeah, okay. That's because they didn't have any supplies in the room, right?
Yeah, speaking of no supplies in the room, how about that looting in Iraq?
Yeah. Oh, no, the looting's reached a fever pitch, and it's been very, very, very bad. People who open up the newspaper or they listen to report on the TV are not getting the full story. If you read what's happening from reporters who are actually in Baghdad and Basra and places like that, it's not just government buildings. It's not just shops, a few shops here and there. It's local hospitals.
It's everything.
Yeah, in Basra, looters have attacked and looted generators and parts that pump water to the city. They've poked holes with their Kalashnikovs in the pipelines that move water to various portions of the city, so even more residents are now short of water in Basra. The British troops have not been able to do the minimum under the Geneva Conventions to protect civilian infrastructure like the power supply or the water supply to Basra. It's just incredible. In Umkaza, where Jay Garner, Jav just called him the viceroy of Iraq. He was just appointed by Rumsfeld to run the military administration in Iraq. He's a former general. He has been trying to set up shop in Umkaza, and his staffers have not been able to find a building that is suitable because all of the office buildings have been stripped bare. Carpet has been stolen, the switch plates on the wall, the light fixtures, everything, including any of the buildings that had any intact windows. The windows have been removed. So there's simply nowhere for them to go. They have to set up tents. That's an ominous sign of what's going to happen in Baghdad if the looting is allowed to continue. Now, I've been reading reports from Reuters reporters and Robert Fisk of The Independent and several other people on the scene in Baghdad who have said that the major hospitals in the city are closed because looters have come in and stolen everything from operating tables to medicines, and have, because they're armed with rifles that they've stolen from looted police departments, these guys are scaring away the doctors and nurses, and so none of the medical personnel are even coming in. So people are going to the hospital, finding nobody there, and they're laying down and dying.
Yeah, it really is chaos there. And remember a couple of things. Number one, this is already a fairly heavily armed country, and the additional looting of police stations bodes ill for the future chaos, both in the major cities like Baghdad and in smaller places. We had already been talking about a major humanitarian crisis. We had already been talking about 12 years of economic sanctions and the toll that had taken on the public health and on people's ability to get food and safe drinking water and all the rest of that. That number one has created the kind of privation and desperation that has helped feed some of the looting, but it also has made it an even more desperate situation for people who might have been fed or might have been housed or somehow sheltered with some of the things that have subsequently been looted. It means that the American responsibility for taking care of these people, for managing the quote-unquote humanitarian crisis, just got a whole lot more difficult, a whole lot more expensive, and the probable inability to do it is going to reflect that much more poorly on the Americans in the Muslim world.
Yeah, and we saw this week, too, the looting of UN headquarters in UN offices in Baghdad in particular. The UNICEF office was witnessed. The looting of the UNICEF office was witnessed by a lot of reporters who said that they saw files on childhood diseases in Iraq scattered all over the place. And a lot of these buildings are also being set on fire after they've been looted. This is a particular concern for the Iraqi government buildings that are being destroyed, burned down, computers being stolen, so files are disappearing. that the concern is that the U.S. will not be able to have the information on who was a member of Saddam Hussein's government, what they were in charge of, who was a member of the military, and when, where were they stationed, did they participate in gassing people. They don't have any information on who was arrested and for what crimes, where they were held, whether they were tortured. They won't have any information on the weapons of mass destruction programs. All that information will be gone.
And what this in turn means, and we just keep piling on top of one another because so much of this stuff hasn't really been characterized in U.S. media reports. What this in turn means is that the United States and Britain are going to be that much more dependent on quote-unquote human intelligence. And we've seen in Afghanistan what that does is people who want petty revenge on the family that they don't like, or the tribal or the village chieftain or power broker that they don't like, they tell the Americans that, yeah, that guy over there, he used to be an enforcer for the Ba'ath Party, and the Americans go after him. Well, it just happened to be somebody who married a sister they didn't like or something like that. I mean, it can turn into a real nasty quagmire where the Americans and the Brits really have no idea what they're doing.
Yeah, and we see a lot of Iraq turning into Afghanistan, and that has just been happening in the last couple of days. People are afraid to leave their houses because if they leave their houses to look for food and water, looters will come. And
they'll come to the house.
Yeah, they'll come to the house and they'll steal everything that these people have. We're seeing people not going to work to staff the hospitals or any of the ministries or to help out any of the U.S. soldiers in their job trying to keep order in the city, because if they leave home, their homes will be destroyed. If they drive to work and park their car will be gone. It'll be stolen. So literally, the city is shut down. It's very much like what had happened in Afghanistan in places where there was no civil control.
Yeah, and to review our history from 16 months ago, because there seems to be a collective amnesia in the United States about how Afghanistan has been handled since the fall of the Taliban. You had all of this tremendous looting and quote unquote anarchy in the major cities, in Kandahar, in Kabul, well, particularly Kandahar, with the absence of a civil authority after the Taliban left. What you saw over the next few months was the United States strong arm a puppet government into place in the capital city and leave the rest of the country pretty much to whoever wanted to carve it up. And the same is very much in danger of happening, I think, in Iraq, where the Americans are just going to look at the expense of this. They're going to look at the extent of the humanitarian crisis. They're going to look at their lack of knowledge of who to rely on. And in this case, they don't have the Northern Alliance. They don't have an existing opposition group with even any kind of minimal credibility to step into much of the country and take over. So in many ways, it's even a worse situation.
Well, you were mentioning tribal chieftains seeking revenge. Isn't that tribal chieftains the people that the U.S. and the Brits are proposing to take over situations here?
Exactly. And we saw some problems with that this week in southern Iraq, where the Brits put in place a man, they called him local sheikh, who had a lot of influence. They put him in place in Basra, or they were trying to put him in control of the city.
This is a city of a million people.
Yeah, a couple million people, yeah. And they didn't tell anybody what his name was at first. They said, well, we just have this guy. We're not going to tell you who he is, which made reporters wonder, well, who is this guy? They're not going to tell us who he is. And locals said, well, who is this guy? So after a few days of that, the Brits finally announced who it was. It turns out the guy's name is Tamimi. And when they announced who he was, everybody kind of scratched their heads in disbelief and said, this can't be the same guy. It can't be the same guy. And it turns out it is the same guy they were thinking of. He was a brigadier general under Saddam Hussein. He was in the Hussein's military. He was a member of the Ba'ath Party, and he's responsible for a lot of oppression in southern Iraq. And as soon as he was announced, a huge crowd gathered outside of his house and started to chant and throw rocks at his house and demand that he be removed because they didn't want any tribal chieftains imposed on them or any members, former, any former or anyone who had been a member of the Ba'ath Party. And it turns out that a lot of these protesters pointed out something that the Brits and the Americans have totally forgotten or ignored, that Saddam Hussein had played favorites among the chieftains and used a lot of the tribal power to play groups against each other in Iraqi society in order to keep control. And by stepping in and saying, we're going to put a local sheikh in control, the Brits and the Americans are walking right into that same kind of a situation where they're looking exactly like Saddam Hussein did to these local people by saying, we're going to put this guy in control and we're not going to give you a chance to vote for or against him, and he's the guy who's going to run things. It's making the Brits look exactly, Brits in Basel look exactly like Saddam Hussein.
Yeah, and in fact, the same kind of strategy that has been used by the Americans in some parts of Afghanistan and by some of the warlords there, and the same kind of history that's historically been used by imperial powers to divide and conquer. So it was, you know, the whole setup just sent off alarm bells for an awful lot of people, both inside Iraq and outside. You know, and let's not forget that part of the larger concern over how this is all played out, there has never been any doubt that the Americans and British and, you know, whoever else was going to sign on, the six troops from Latvia who were sent down for the occasion, you know, had the military firepower to overrun Iraq. That's never been in question. The part that has been in question is this going to be helpful for the security of the United States? And for that, you have to look at the response to the war amongst the larger Muslim world and amongst the larger international community. And, you know, so far, aside from the very welcome downfall of Saddam Hussein, nobody's shedding tears over his loss because dictators have no friends. You know, the Americans and Brits have not handled this very well. And, you know, when you have the United States government and the Bush administration talking, and many of the neocons in Washington talking very openly about, well, this has been a splendid success, who can we go after next? Really alarming a lot of people.
Well, and then what they do is they go in and they overthrow an administration that was functional, and they put in place something that's not functional, and that that governments that have operated in the Middle East know is not functional, which is the rule by little local warlords. It's not working in Afghanistan, has never worked in Afghanistan, and it's not going to work in Iraq. And it, in fact, there's already been some factional fighting breaking out in the city of Najaf just a couple of days ago. Two Shiite clerics were hacked to death in a mosque. Now, there wasn't a lot of explanation who these two guys were. One of them was a guy who was the son of a very, very prominent Shiite ruler who had left the country right after the Gulf War because his father had been murdered by Saddam. He left and lived in Britain. Has lived in Britain for 12 years during the whole time of the sanctions in Iraq. Well, he got together. He came in with American troops and went around and did a little piece, bit of few peacekeeping things in that area of the country around Najaf, and was always escorted by U.S. troops. And he went to the local Shiite leader who had been supported by Saddam Hussein, and he said, "Let's do a show of unity. You and I go to the mosque, and we'll meet with some of the holdouts there who were former Saddam Ba'ath Party members who had sought sanctuary in the mosque. We'll go there and we'll try to negotiate their release, and we'll try to do this as a show of unity and to try to do it as a reconciliation thing." They went to the mosque, and it turns out that there was another local Shiite sheikh. You know, I mean, all these various heads of tribes and stuff. His followers showed up, objected to these people going into the mosque. "How dare you? You used to be a member of the Ba'ath Party. You used to oppress us in league with this guy that the Americans brought in who's been living abroad and doesn't even know what the situation is here." And they hacked the two guys to death.
Yeah, and you know, when we talked before the war started about some of the worst case scenarios for ways in which this could go completely awry, the invasion, that is, and we talked about the law of unintended consequences and how wars were notorious for unleashing unintended consequences. Pretty much one of the worst case scenarios, aside from maybe a use of weapons of mass destruction, was that Iraq slides into civil war and the country falls into pieces, and it winds up being divided into either multiple different countries, such as Kurdistan, etc., or it just falls into
the kind of chaos we've seen in Afghanistan for about 20 years.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, if at this point it's either going to settle down very quickly or the Americans are going to have to bring in many more personnel than they have on the scene right now and keep them there in order to maintain order, or we're going to see another Afghanistan.
Sorry.
A little cough from Mike there.
Yeah. So yeah, you've been too close to us for the last few minutes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I'm catching some. So what's happening in the north?
In the north, we've seen the Kurds go into Kirkuk, which is the main city in northern Iraq. And the Kurds have always considered Kirkuk their sort of historic capital of that part of what they would think of as a greater Kurdistan. And the Kurds had made a promise to Turkey. Now, we talked about this on the show a few weeks or maybe a couple months back, that they would not enter Kirkuk, because if they did enter Kirkuk, Turkey would then see that as a provocation.
Yeah,
oh, the Kurds want to use that as their capital city and set up a Kurdistan, and then Turkey would want to invade.
Yeah,
well,
but
in fact,
that was the quid pro quo for Turkey not sending their army into
right,
the northern part of Iraq.
Right, is that the Kurds would stay out of Kirkuk and let U.S. troops go in instead. Well, what happened was there were too few U.S. troops on the scene to prevent the Kurds from just, you know, storming into Kirkuk. And they did march in, they did take control. And it was interesting because they set up what would you call it? I'm too tired to remember. Let's see. They set up a little kind of mini government right away, something that the Americans and the Brits have not been able to do in any of the southern cities or in Baghdad. They set up their own little kind of mini administration almost right away and started patrolling the streets, and the looting has not been nearly as bad in Kirkuk as it has in other areas of the country. It's been pretty bad in Mosul, but it hasn't been as bad in Kirkuk because the Kurds have started doing a patrol and started grabbing the looters and taking their stuff away from them right away. But the U.S. troops and the U.S. administration said, oh, no, the Kurds are going to withdraw from Kirkuk, but reporters on the scene said that there's no sign of it and that they're not even beginning to try to leave the city.
And let's not forget that this is exactly what happened in Afghanistan when the Northern Alliance was not supposed to be going into Kabul.
And
the Northern
anyway.
Alliance just jumped into Kabul, and that was how you got a number of the warlords into the inner circle of Karzai's government, is because they embedded themselves, to use the fashionable term, into the provisional administration of Kabul in the first few days, and they've been there ever since. And so you've got these people with tremendous backgrounds of committing atrocities being part of the running of quote unquote modern Afghanistan under the watchful gaze of the United States.
And the Kurds took that as a lesson. They realized that if they didn't go into Kirkuk, that they wouldn't have that city, and they wanted that city, and they took it. And that means that Turkey is now going to view that as a provocation, and we could see Turkish troops invading northern Iraq soon.
All right, moving along. Harm missile in the market.
Yeah, well, there's been a number of reports over the past couple of weeks of, you know, it's been like every day or two that you see one or another allegation or reporting of civilian deaths in Iraq, and there have actually civilian death. What's the name of the website that's been tracking?
It's called www.iraqbodycount.org.
That's it. Yeah.
.net, I believe, is the suffix.
I think that's right. But anyway, they've been doing a pretty good tally of the reported deaths in Iraq.
And it really is a minimal tally,
yeah.
Just the ones that have been reported by written press accounts.
Yeah, so it's fairly conservative, but you know, many of these the response from the Pentagon has been, well, it's under investigation, or well, that never happened, and there's no follow up by U.S. media. And the prime example of that so far has been the market deaths that happened fairly early on in Baghdad, where over 60 people, and the classic, I forget whether it was the Times or the PI, but the headline was 18 dead in Iraq reported reports dozens. 18 dead in Market. Or no, the
dozens.
Other one said
yeah.
one said 18 and the other said dozens.
Yeah.
I think it was the Times that said 18 and the PI was more generous with the dozens. But it turned out to be over 60.
That was just the people who were killed. Many, yeah. many, many more. Something around 400, as high as 400 were injured.
Yeah, and probably many of those injured have subsequently died because of the
lack of medical care.
But the line at the time from the Pentagon was, well, this was probably an Iraqi missile that went astray. And of course, you know, there was some sort of obvious fallaciousness in that reasoning. Why would the Iraqis be firing a missile over a populated area of residential Baghdad unless there was a U.S. aircraft already making a bombing run there? But
yeah. And I wasn't aware that Iraq had any missiles actually in the center of the city.
Yeah, that's true, too. So that was already questionable, but there was very little follow-up by the U.S. However, a couple of days later, I believe it was Robert Fisk of The Independent, reported that some fragments from the missile had been found in the Marketplace area and that one of them had included a serial number. And the British paper for which he worked, The Independent, traced down the serial number, and lo and behold, it was traced back to Raytheon Corporation in New England of the United States of America. Most probably, in terms of the size of the crater as well was one of the HARM missiles that was being used by the United States. And the United States had already reported, embedded reporters had reported, that I believe it was the Kitty Hawk missile, aircraft carrier rather, had fired a HARM missile at Baghdad on that day. So you have pretty much all of the elements that are in place to confirm that it was a U.S. missile that intentionally or not, and of course we've been hearing all of this grandiose praise about the accuracy of American weaponry. Either it is very accurate, in which case it's intentional, or it's not very accurate, was responsible for the civilian deaths.
In which case it was irresponsible.
Yeah. So, one way or another, the United States is responsible for a tremendous number of civilian deaths. And again, you would think this would be a story. It has been fairly responsibly confirmed at this point in American media. It has been reported in Britain, but we don't hear it here in the United States.
As well as I had heard a story this week about the Palestine hotel getting hit, like three journalists there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, yeah. That's an interesting story in itself. In fact, the U.S., the head of the troops that were in that area, I think it was a colonel, who was in charge of the troops that were in that area and actually fired on the Palestine Hotel, said that there was some weapons fire coming from the lobby of the hotel itself. Well, there was a journalist on the road who was driving on the road in between the tanks and the hotel, said he heard no weapons fire when the missile was being fired. There were journalists all throughout that building who were filming and watching the tanks in action across the river, and they said that there was no weapons fire coming from anywhere in the vicinity of the hotel, and that in fact they had regularly posted guards to make sure that there were no snipers or other Iraqis who took up any kind of station nearby the hotel because they didn't want to draw any kind of American tank fire to the hotel. And in fact, if they were firing from the lobby, why then did the tank shoot at, I believe it was the 15th or the 18th floor?
Yeah, and you have had the group Reporters Without Borders, which is an international advocacy group for journalists, basically say that it was an intentional murder, that the Americans intentionally fired at a hotel where a number of journalists were known to be staying,
and
including
it was
journalists
well
from the Arab
known.
World.
It was very, very well known that that's where the press was staying.
Right, and these are non-embedded journalists.
Right,
yes,
and at the same time, on the same day, U.S. plane targeted and destroyed the Al Jazeera headquarters in Baghdad and the headquarters for the, I believe it was the Abu Dhabi TV in Baghdad. And in fact, the U.S. military had the coordinates for those two buildings in their system as being media buildings, not enemy targets. So,
and how many different consecutive U.S. invasions does it take where independent journalists or independent TV stations are intentionally or rather are destroyed, and the United States claims it was an accident? How many of these coincidences have to pile up before anybody in this country begins to believe that it's not simply coincidence?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Moving along, Jackie Hudson, a member of a local peace organization.
Yeah, she's been involved for many years over in Kitsap County with Ground Zero and also with the Northwest Disarmament Coalition here in town. Some folks here in town know that she, along with two other nuns, one from Baltimore and one from Saginaw, Michigan, were arrested several months ago in Colorado as part of a plowshares action in which they entered into the area where a missile silo was kept and poured their blood in the shape of, I guess, spray painted their blood in the shape of six crosses onto the missile and stood and prayed over it and waited for an hour until the Marines came, and the Marines came in and with their show of Rambo force arrested them. Well, they were convicted in a federal court in Denver this week of obstructing the national defense, which is one of those grandiose new Patriot Act type offenses that the federal government has now put in place with which to take previously fairly minimal offenses, particularly minimal offenses that the people practicing civil disobedience are prone to engage in, and slap a number of additional years on them in terms, and also make much more vague the criteria for conviction. So they are now facing, with sentencing on July 25th, up to 30 years in prison, although the federal prosecutor in the case has said fairly confidently that he expects that they'll only get 5 to 8 years. They've already been in jail since the original incident, and now these are all women who are in their 60s, I believe, all of them. Jackie is 67. They are literally the archetype of little old lady nuns, and they and their supporters, many of whom are from the Catholic worker and Catholic left communities around the country, have been really quite adamant and quite appalled in taking what was, by every imaginable description, a nonviolent witness against weapons of mass destruction, and that the United States is hammering these women for what they've done.
Kind of the opposite of what they're doing, hammering missiles and the plowshares, the U.S.'s
something like that, yeah. That you know, it's our weapons of mass destruction are sacrosanct. It's just everybody else's that are verboten.
And in a lot of these cases, like for instance with woman from University Baptist, where she was thrown in jail.
Oh, and Reverend Amit Hall.
Right,
mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
And they're thrown in jail, and like she was like denied like migraine medicine and stuff. I mean, yes. It's like, you know,
it just petty vindictiveness, yeah, is often what it comes,
yeah,
down to. Yeah,
I can testify to how painful a migraine can be when you don't have your medicine.
Yeah, for folks who don't understand what we're referring to, the Seattle 12, the folks who were arrested, I think it was last December, down at the federal building for protesting the then proposed invasion in Afghanistan. Two of the people convicted of that crime, Gene Buskin, whose peace calendar we use in Eat the State each issue, and who's been a longtime activist around town, and Reverend Ann Hall, who's a co-pastor at University Baptist Church, had prior federal convictions, so they were sentenced to local jail. Gene just got out after 20 days, and Reverend Hall was in for 7 days. And Reverend Hall has medicine that she uses for chronic migraine headaches, and she was denied the medicine. So she was basically in agony for 24/7 for the 7 days she was there. She was finally let out a day early just because she was suffering so badly. But it was just completely unnecessary.
Yeah, absolutely
torture.
Unnecessary. If she just had her medicine, she could have stopped it.
All right, 1 minute or less. Governor Locke's got a bill on his desk. He's probably got a lot of them.
Yeah, but one in particular, House Bill 2030, I believe it is, that repeals a tax, or actually reforms the local B&O tax to prevent cities from charging companies for business that is not done within the jurisdiction of the city. And this is basically a tax cut for big business. It's a huge tax cut for big business that is likely to take millions of dollars out of the coffers of cities around the state,
including Seattle,
at the time when almost all all of those cities are very badly facing shortfalls in their budgets, and at a time when local politicians, as well as politicians at the state level, are not putting any other measures in that could raise revenues to counteract this. So you have this enormous tax cut at the time when there's a state budget shortfall as well, and you also have Governor Locke and the Republicans and many of the Democrats pledging, oh, well, we won't raise any taxes, but we're going to cut taxes, and then we're not going to take responsibility for the shortfalls and the lost services that are going to happen as a result.
And the real crime is that Governor Locke actually pushed for this tax to be this tax cut to be put in place, and he's going to sign it. There's no question.
Yeah, very much so.
All right, well, with that, we're out of time. Talking this week with John Parrish, Maria Tomchek, co-editors at Eat the State. And quickly, where can people find Eat the State?
It is comes out every other week, a free biweekly publication, available where you get free papers around town, bookstores and cafes and whatnot. We're hoping in the next issue or two to actually have a full list. Maybe we'll even start reading some of them on this program. You can also find us on the web at www.eatthestate.org. And we have some events coming up today also that that we should plug very briefly, because there's a calendar on the back page. There's a peace rally at noon today. There's a tax resistance thing on tax day next Tuesday, the 15th, from 4 to 7 at Westlake. There's a queer party at SCCC from 2 to 5 today. There are people are going to be having a festival out in the hall. Anyway,
where's the peace rally today?
Oh, the peace rally is at Volunteer Park. I'm sorry.
At time?
Noon.
Noon.
Yeah,
okay.
I'm sorry. I thought I said that, but we're short on time, so we're just rushing through it.
And sleep.
And sleep and wellness and all those things. Anyway, if you have any questions or want further information from Eat the State, you can call the voicemail at 206
903 9461.
Thank you very much.